From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Suddenly, the Middle East appears set to go into diplomatic overdrive over a new Saudi peace plan. A traditionally aloof Crown Prince Abdullah has offered to break the bloody stalemate between Israel and the Palestinians. If Israel withdraws from the West Bank and Gaza Strip back to its 1967 borders, then he says the Arab world will finally recognize the Israeli state. The Land for Peace idea isn't new, but the fact that it's coming from Saudi Arabia is. The Royal House of Saud has never pressed for peace with Israel, but with Israeli-Palestinian violence mounting daily and the war on terror at the Saudis' doorstep, Prince Abdullah's timing is spectacular. I spoke with Dennis Ross earlier today. He led Middle East peace negotiations under Presidents Bush and Clinton. He brought the Israelis and Palestinians together to reach the 1995 interim agreement and brokered the Hebron Accord in 1997. I asked Dennis Ross to assess the significance of the new Saudi proposal.
I think the significance of the Saudi proposal is less in its content and more in its timing. Let me explain what I mean by that. The content is not new. Mm-hmm. We went to Madrid based on the premise of land for peace. And in effect, what the Saudis are saying today publicly is they're prepared to offer peace, meaning normalization, in return for land. Mm-hmm. That's the essence of what they're saying, full normalization for full withdrawal. That's not a new formulation. But it's significant now because at a point when there looks to be no hope, when it looks to be a very little prospect that there can be peaceful coexistence, the Saudi move sends a signal that, look, we are still committed to peace. And at a time when the Israelis, because of the violence of the last year and a lot of the hostility that's been directed towards Israel by the Arab world, at a time of that sort, I think it does have a psychological impact there. I think the Israelis in particular have been desperate to see some sign that there could be acceptance again of Israel. Their expectations have been raised very high before the eruption of the Intifada. Mm-hmm. Now their point of view has been, I think, very much damaged in terms of the whole issue of peace. So what the Saudis are doing at this point, I think, does send a signal that suggests that peace is still a possibility. And from that standpoint, I think it's important.
Dennis Ross, what do you make of the unorthodox way in which this proposal was floated in a conversation with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman? Very unusual, isn't it?
It is, but I think here you have to look at what's also going on with the Saudis. The Saudis have become extremely concerned about how they're perceived within the United States. The fact that they invited the Washington Post and the New York Times and then Tom Friedman to come and see the Crown Prince is an indication that they realize they had a problem and they have to begin to address that problem. I think in the first instance, the motivation for this had much less to do with peace and much more to do with the relations with us. Having said that, once you take this kind of a step, once you begin to generate a position, once others begin to respond to it, it takes on a life of its own. Even if the original motivation was different, I think the consequence is still meaningful.
What do you think of the growing chorus of interest that's developed since it came out? President Bush has spoken to it now. Obviously, Javier Solana is on his way to Jeddah to talk with the Saudis. Palestinian authorities already giving the plan their full backing. Is this a significant mounting of support?
I think what it represents is there's nothing else out there. Mm-hmm. There's basically a vacuum, and unfortunately the vacuum has been filled until now with violence. We don't have a dialogue about peace, we have a dialogue about violence. So here's a new factor. In a situation where both sides are basically trapped in an endless spiral of violence that gets worse and worse with no prospect of an endpoint, something new has to be created to affect the situation. Quite honestly, I don't know that this is sufficient because it doesn't deal with the violence itself. But I do think it's a new factor.
The land for peace formulation, as you say, is not new. But the Saudis, in going all the way to this extreme of complete withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza in return for complete recognition, are sticking out a more radical version of land for peace than has been on the table, are they not?
Not from the standpoint of principle. What they're doing is they're defining it, and they're defining it in a maximal sense. Mm-hmm. The Israelis have to give back all the territory if they want to get all the peace. If you go back to Hafez al-Assad, he offered a formula himself in the mid-1990s, which was full peace for full withdrawal. Well, that's the equivalent of what we're hearing now. Mm-hmm. What we had on the table with the Clinton ideas at the end of the Clinton administration with regard to the Palestinians was nearly complete withdrawal. About 95% of the West Bank would have been given back. Mm-hmm. There would have been a territorial swap so that Gaza would have been increased in size by one-third, and the net would have been about 97% of the whole territory. So it wasn't 100%, and in return there was going to be an end of the conflict. There would have been real peace. I think the significance, again, of the Saudi position is that it's a new factor that says, look, we believe in peace, and here's our principle for a kind of formula to get there. You still have to negotiate the principle. What 242 and 338, the two Security Council resolutions, mandate are principles for negotiations. They don't mandate an outcome. Land for peace was never defined. The way you give it definition is by negotiating what it means. So this should be seen not as a kind of rigid formula in which there can be no give and take on it. It should be seen instead as a psychological move designed to demonstrate that there is a possibility of peace. If it's seen that way, it's useful. If it becomes a rigid formula, quite frankly, it will not be useful.
So if it should spark the parties back into some kind of negotiation, do you anticipate that they would quickly get back to the kind of parameters of the Camp David talks in the Clinton administration, or are the Saudis trying to push this in a new direction with a more thorough land for peace exchange?
I don't think it's the latter. I think what the Saudis are trying to do is to create a new factor that can restart a political process. We have no political process right now. We have no negotiations right now. For the Israelis, having an image that there could be something possible will create pressures within Israel on the Sharon government. But Sharon has made it very clear, while he is prepared to go back to negotiations, he's not prepared to go back to negotiations in an environment of violence. So I think what has to happen is you have to take the Saudi proposal and you're going to have to marry it to a proposal geared towards stopping the violence. For the Palestinians, the value of the Saudi proposal could be that it offers a vision of what the political process might produce. Having that vision could then justify stopping the violence on the grounds that, look, we have a lot to gain if we pursue the political track now, and you can see how much we're losing if we don't.
And if the violence can't be stopped, you know there have been radical ideas floated over the past few months as people have been fed up with the bloodshed, even the notion of an imposed peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. Is it possible that the Saudis could be nudging in that direction?
I have no doubt that probably in the back of the Saudi mind, even if the original motivation was more to address their relationship with us, I have no doubt that in the back of their mind there is a desire to simply have the U.S. come in and impose these terms. The Arab world has always operated on a premise that somehow it's better to impose a settlement than to actually try to negotiate it. Mm-hmm. The problem has been that when it's imposed, you don't have to make the hard decisions. And if, in fact, there is dissatisfaction with the outcome, at the first opportunity for defection, you'll see defection. I have always been against imposition because I don't think that it can endure, and I think it's kind of perpetuating the idea that peace doesn't really have to be real. All it has to do is reflect a kind of absence of conflict. Imposition can create absence of conflict, but it can't create reconciliation. Ultimately, if you want peace to endure, it's got to be based on reconciliation.
Dennis Ross, as you say, people are greeting this with interest because the alternatives are so bloody at the moment. You've been around the region so much. Do you see this as a sincere gesture on the Saudis' part, a sincere effort toward peace, or is this perhaps primarily an effort to get back into the good graces of the United States after a very rocky period between the two countries?
Well, you know, it can be both. You know, I do believe that it was more motivated by a desire to appeal to us. But I also do believe that the Saudis, especially Crown Prince Abdullah, who I have spent a fair amount of time with in the past, is concerned about what he sees happening to the Palestinians. And I think he would like to do something, and he also realizes that doing something can take some of the pressure off of him from within Saudi Arabia. One thing that has happened in the Middle East because of the emergence of satellite TVs is that you've seen the Palestinian conflict Arabized again. During the course of the 1990s, it really lost its Arab character, mostly because the Arab world looked at this, was more removed from it, saw the United States managing a very intensive process, and believed basically the conflict would end. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you see the Intifada and they see nightly images on their TVs, which from their standpoint are just awful in terms of what are perceived efforts by the Israelis to brutalize the Palestinians, at least in Arab eyes. And as a result, there's real anger on the streets, especially in Saudi Arabia. So this is also an effort, I think, to respond to what might be an internal set of pressures that the Crown Prince in particular has been aware of.
If this plan doesn't take off, if it should lose altitude, lose traction, where are we headed in the Israeli-Palestinian standoff, Dennis Ross?
Well, I'm very worried about where we're headed. I see us on a spiral that is basically characterized daily by new thresholds of violence being crossed on both sides and with no end point. I myself have suggested that we think both about conventional responses and unconventional responses. Conventional responses that, from my standpoint, would involve giving the Palestinians 10 days to perform without being pressed by the Israelis in terms of attacks. It's a risk for the Israelis to run that because they could well be attacked during that period by suicide bombers. But it's also a risk not to try something new. I do think if you give the Palestinians the opportunity to do what they need to do in terms of arrests, in terms of collecting illegal weapons, in terms of preventing, actively trying to prevent acts of terror, and they don't perform, then there has to be a consequence. And I would favor suspending relations with Arafat in such a circumstance. But that's
suspending
more of a
suspending whose relations with Arafat, Dennis?
The U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Suspension is not termination. Mm-hmm. You suspend with conditions, and you would resume if the conditions are met.
And what would the ramifications of suspension of relations be?
I think the main ramification would be that Arafat would understand that from his standpoint, his cause, which is the essence of how he defines himself, was being jeopardized because the U.S., which is so critical to the promotion of that cause in his eyes, was taking a very clear step away from him personally. Now, others in the region might not like it, but if they also saw that this was done only after the Palestinians were given the opportunity to act and fulfill their responsibilities in an environment where we had persuaded the Israelis to stand down, I think that would create a lot of pressure on Arafat to act, and I think we would then be in a position where you might well be able to launch more of a political process. You could see the Tenet plan and the Mitchell plans, which have been adopted but never carried out, perhaps implemented at that point. But I would also couple it to something else. I would couple it to a major humanitarian initiative on our part to ease the plight of Palestinians. And I would do something else. Both Israelis and Palestinians over the last 2 weeks have approached me and said, we've got to find a way out of this.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these were people who were outside of the formal structures. And they have said to me that they believe that they could outline what would be a fair solution, not a formula like what the Saudis are offering. The Saudis are offering a simple formula that still has to be negotiated.
Mm-hmm.
They are offering to negotiate an outline that would be a fair solution where both sides make compromises. The significance of that is that I think it would show both publics that there is an alternative out there and that peaceful coexistence is not an illusion.
You've spoken to Arafat's situation a bit. How about Prime Minister Sharon's?
I think he's under a lot of pressure from within Israel, and I think that we're beginning to see a polarization between the left and the right in Israel. For the last year, nobody believed there were any possibilities. But after a year of crossing thresholds with violence and not being able to stop the terror, I think there are more and more Israelis, at least on the left side of the spectrum, who are again beginning to become politically active. The right is also becoming more active in terms of putting pressure on the prime minister, and he's kind of caught in a situation where each side within the Israeli polity is demanding something that will change the situation, but what they're demanding is completely different. And so he's wrestling right now with how do you keep a coalition together that has very different points of view in it. So I think he, too, would find some benefit in something that changes the situation, although there will be a political price.
Dennis Ross, are you more or less optimistic than you were a month ago?
I would say I'm marginally more hopeful. I would like to be more, but I think to really change the situation, you have to go beyond formulas, and you really have to change the realities on the ground. The psychology is so sour and so bad that you've got to demonstrate to each that what they want out of a peace process can be reestablished. The Israelis need security. The Palestinians need to know that Israelis will no longer control their lives. That's where a major effort has to be made.
Dennis Ross was Special Middle East Envoy under President Clinton. He spoke with us earlier today from Florida. Joining us now is Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, you can hear Dennis Ross with all of his experience teetering there between a little bit of hope and a lot of potential despair.
Yeah, and if you look at today's Jerusalem Post, you can see why the despair and the hope. The Post today has a series of articles about what you might call the war on pregnant women. It's come to this. The brutalization has come to this. In the last 4 days, 4 pregnant women have been wounded, 2 Palestinians, 2 Israelis, husbands of a couple of them killed. In the Palestinian cases, they were both women being rushed to the hospital and shot on the road. In the Israeli case, it was a deliberate retaliation against, sort of pregnant woman for pregnant woman. I mean, that is to say, the Palestinian case. It's come to this.
New thresholds of violence being crossed daily by both sides, Dennis Ross says. Is the Saudi plan a candle in the dark night, a beacon? Is it momentous or just a ploy? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new peace plan floated by Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Abdullah. There is just a hope that maybe it might break the long-standing and bloody stalemate between Israel and the Arab world. In the Saudi plan, Arab countries would recognize Israel in return for Israel's complete withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Could this be a real escape from the bloodbath? Is it the last hope for peace in the Middle East? Could the Saudis hold the key? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Dennis Sullivan. He's chairman of the Department of Political Science at Northeastern University and has consulted for the World Bank on Middle East projects. Good evening and welcome, Dennis Sullivan.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Dennis Sullivan, look at this with us regionally for a moment, if you will. We get mesmerized in an awful way by the violence between Israelis and Palestinians, but there is a very strong regional context right now. There's been an array of responses around the Middle East to the Saudi proposal. What's going on in regional terms? The Saudis are talking about bringing this plan before the Arab League meeting next month, March 27th,
right,
in Beirut.
Yes, exactly.
What's the regional framework for this floated proposal?
Well, that's the regional one I'm still waiting to hear, frankly. The Israeli reception has been positive. The Palestinian Authority reception is positive. Certainly globally it's been quite positive, with both the European Union and the United States praising this, accepting it, basically wanting to take it and run. And it'll be very interesting to see, in fact, if the Saudis, in fact, even present this at the Arab League. I'm hopeful, certainly, that they will. A little hesitant to say that they will, in fact. Regionally, I think what really will, as you introduced it, will does Saudi Arabia hold the key? No, they don't hold the key. But if they have just given this a nudge, now the parties that will hold the key certainly are Israel and Palestine, but also Egypt and Jordan, I think, are the next two players that really need to run with this, because obviously the two Arab states that are already at peace with Israel, both of them having a quite cold peace with the Israelis, but if they can use this, and if the Palestinian Authority President Arafat will also embrace it, then if you get a coalition of those four major players, then I think there's something really significant here.
Well, of course, President Arafat, the Palestinian Authority anyway, has already come out very strongly saying, you know, yes, we're for that.
Absolutely.
President Bush spoke out today praising Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah and the plan for its vision of Israeli-Arab normalization. That's a long way from endorsing the details.
Sure.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana is headed to Jeddah tomorrow. Syria has said nothing yet. I haven't read of any response from Egypt and Jordan.
Exactly.
You mentioned those two. How do you think that it might be received in Egypt and Jordan? How will they be calculating what noises to make about the Saudi proposal?
This is the really strange thing almost about both Egypt and Jordan, because they both are, as I said, at peace with Israel. You would think they'd be the two that would really, you'd think they were the two we hear from first, in addition to Israel and the Palestinians.
Then why not?
Why not? Because the Egyptians still are calculating this. The Egyptians continue to have a very strange relationship with Israel. They have a peace treaty, and as I said, it's a very cold peace.
Why?
They're very down on normalization right now because of the violence in Israel and Palestine.
But that seems like an endless argument.
It is.
If you won't support peace and you're against violence, there's no way out of that route.
Right. It's only, I tell you, the frustration, I feel it every day. I'm trying to bring, I'm running an institute this summer in which we're trying to bring Israelis, Palestinians, Saudis, Egyptians all together in a kind of educational forum. And the Palestinians are the first ones to, you know, embrace this. They live with Israelis. They know that they have to live with Israelis. The Egyptian students and some teachers that I've talked to are hesitant about the normalization. It's very frustrating.
So by that, do you mean that they're hesitant about the notion of the Arab League, the Arab states, acknowledging, recognizing the Israeli state.
No, this is what's bizarre about it, because you would
think
that they are already out on this limb. They were the first ones to go out on this limb. You'd think that they would be the first to embrace the Saudi proposal and say, yes, just like we did, now the rest of the Arab world has to do it. So what's going on is domestic internal Egyptian politics.
Is this Islamic fundamentalism that makes it impossible for political leaders to embrace the idea of peaceful coexistence with Israel?
I would say not so much in Egypt. In fact, which again is very, I'm sorry to complicate this. We would think Egypt is the most straightforward, but...
We can deal with complications here, Dennis Sullivan.
Fine.
Lay them on us.
Good. The Egyptian government has, in fact, already really destroyed most of its Islamic, quote-unquote, fundamentalist militancy, even before September 11th. They continue to have internal left-wing and other opposition to normalization with Israel. So,
but are you telling me that Egypt would not support a plan in which Israel completely withdrew, I mean, if that would ever happen, completely withdrew from occupied territories,
no,
went back to pre-67 borders, and a Palestinian state was acknowledged as Israel would be, that this would be difficult for Egypt to support?
I'm certainly not saying that. Sorry, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is I'm surprised that the Egyptians continue to calculate what inevitably they will do. You know, they're sitting there calculating their response. I think what they're waiting to hear is, what will Syria say? What will Lebanon say? What will Algeria or Morocco say? But in many ways, the world is looking to Egypt next, and Jordan. And I think Jordan's far easier. Jordan, I think, will embrace this quite readily. I'm only going through all of these mental gymnastics with you just to say how surprised I am that the Egyptians aren't the first ones out there.
Jack Beatty, it's remarkable, isn't it? You would think, I mean, of course, this is just the bare bones of a proposal and a radical one. It would have to hit a negotiating table, and who knows what would happen. But what the Saudis are proposing would seem to be something that Egypt could easily support.
Yeah, I just have no sense about that at all. What's interesting is putting this in the context of U.S.-Saudi relations.
Mm-hmm.
And a recent ABC poll found that 10% of Americans consider Saudi an ally, 14% consider it an enemy.
These are low numbers, but high on the enemy side.
Yes, 54% said it was a friendly country but not an ally. Mm-hmm. And Prince Bandar, their representative here, said we have to get to Joe Sixpack. We have to somehow convince Americans who have just seen 15 Saudi citizens commit the greatest terrorist attack in American history. We have to convince Americans somehow that we're not all that bad. And I think this peace announcement, I think, fits in as much to U.S.-Saudi relations as it does to regional relations, because the main Saudi connection in the world is to the United States. It's oil, it's security.
And it's strained.
And it is strained, and it's been strained. I mean, the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago had a series of pieces out of Saudi Arabia pointing out just how strained it had become. In August, before September 11th, the Saudis were just about ready to break off relations. They sent because Bush was not intervening in the violence, and they sent a letter to Bush that said, well, you go your way, and we'll go our way, and that's that. And the White House was shocked, and within 36 hours, Bush turned on a dime and sent a letter to the Saudis that was very important to them because it acknowledged the suffering of the Palestinians. Bush wrote this: I reject this extraordinary un-American bias whereby the blood of an Israeli child is more expensive and holy than the blood of a Palestinian child. I reject people who say when you kill a Palestinian, it is defense. When a Palestinian kills an Israeli, it is a terrorist act. That sentence apparently helped to save a relationship. And it was followed after September 11th, shortly by Bush's statement about the Palestinian state. And, of course, then September 11th introduced this entirely new element. And so the atmospherics here may be as much about Ridya and Washington as they are Ridya and Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Sullivan, Jack Beatty, stand by. Listeners, how do you read the motivations of Saudi Arabia now, of Israel, of the Palestinians? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Lauren is on the line. Welcome, Lauren. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got two basic problems with the plan that's been proposed.
Okay.
The first is I have the feeling that the Saudis are promising more than they can deliver.
Mm-hmm.
They're having a very hard time keeping their own country under wraps. They've had riots with youth. There's a very small ruling family that holds all the power. They're not very popular. September 11th taught us that.
So in terms of what they can deliver, you mean they could presumably deliver their own official endorsement, but they couldn't deliver the rest of the Arab League, or they couldn't keep their own population behind it?
I don't believe that they can necessarily keep their own population behind it. I don't believe that they can deliver the rest of the Arab world necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on which countries have to assent to this, I think that they've made a statement out there, and ideally it would be great if they could have peace.
And your second concern, Lauren?
My second concern is that I doubt if Israel is going to agree to this, because the thing that strikes me in hearing about the Israeli and Palestinian relationship, it's like telling the offer that's on the table is like telling the American settlers 100 years ago, mm-hmm. if you pull back to the eastern side of the Mississippi and let the Native Americans have the rest of it, we'll all, you know, we won't have any more Indian raids anywhere else in the country.
I mean, well, there it is exactly, Lauren. Yeah, but there is the nub of it, isn't it? I mean, the Arab world, the Palestinians, and the United States to date have not been willing to look at the West Bank as the equivalent of everything west of the Alleghenies.
And I think that the status of the Palestinians in that country needs to be looked at the way that the Native Americans in this country has never really been looked at except now. I mean, 100 years ago, people were very blasé about Native Americans and, you know, Indian raiders, and that whole attitude was very strong. And now, you know, we've gotten this whole sentimental brush over a lot of the Native Americans now that they're contained and kind of out of the way, and we'll feature them in the opening of the Olympics. And I think that situation is very similar to what's going on in Israel and in Palestine.
Well,
right,
Lauren, with due respect, I it seems pretty clear that the Palestinians are not willing to just be made contained and out of the way peacefully, and world sentiment doesn't seem to support that, does it?
I don't think it does, and I think the problem is that the Israelis are not accepting that, and the ability to say that they'll pull back.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a groundswell for peace in Israel. I think there's an awful lot of Israeli citizens who are sick to death of war, who'd like to agree to a lot of things, but they're distrustful, and I don't think that it's in the political best interest of the people who are in charge of Israel. There's an awful lot of hawks in government there.
Yes, sure are. Lauren, thank you very much for your call. I want to turn this to Dennis Sullivan.
Yeah.
What about Saudi sway with the Arab League? How strong is it today?
Well, it's certainly strong, and it's mostly subtle and behind the scenes, as the Saudis like to work anyway. So this, just the fact that they've come out and made a statement that they might make a statement is actually quite a huge it's not momentous, but it's quite an achievement, if you will.
What's the nature of Saudi clout? Is it financial? Is it oil wealth? Is it the mastery of the holy sites?
It's certainly financial, most primarily. The holy sites certainly have. It's one of the factors, but really this really comes down to finances, and the Saudis, you know, have been able to bankroll an end to the Lebanese civil war. They can bankroll rapprochement between Arab leaders over decades, mostly with finances. That's why, again, I turn to Egypt, which really has been the preeminent leader within the Arab world. Even when it was outside the Arab League, it held great sway, because the Arab League virtually did nothing anyway while Egypt was out of it. And then again, even when it's in it, there's a great deal of dissension in the ranks.
Dennis Sullivan, stand by. I want to bring in Tony Kerr now. He's a senior editor at Time.com, the online arm of Time magazine. Good evening and welcome, Tony Kerr.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Tony, you've written about the Saudi proposal. What's your interpretation of what's going on here and its chances for making a difference toward peace?
Well, I think the Saudis have essentially seized the initiative because Washington and the Israeli government have pretty much left the arena of peace proposals dormant. Essentially, what you've had is Washington's policy over the last year has essentially been the same as that of the Sharon government, which is essentially one that's based on security, that the focus is entirely on bringing violence under control and not really looking beyond at what any kind of vision of a peace agreement might still be. The Saudis have moved into the vacuum, and essentially I think they've actually wrong-footed the United States and Israel in the process, and probably Egypt too, actually.
What do you mean by that, Tony?
Well, essentially, nobody was expecting this. Essentially, what the Saudis have said is, look, peace is possible. Here are the terms for it. What they've said is not all that new. It's essentially the same as United Nations Resolution 242, which was the underpinning of Oslo. It's also restated by Secretary of State Colin Powell as U.S. standing U.S. policy.
Of course, it's more radical if you interpret it literally than what was on the table at Camp David with Clinton. This is 100% at the moment, anyway, unadulterated return of occupied territories as opposed to 95 or 97%.
Well, I don't think that's strictly true. I think essentially what they're saying is a negotiation on the basis of a return to the 67 borders, because from what Crown Prince Abdullah has said is he is prepared to acknowledge some sort of territorial transfer, you know, some Israel keeping some settlements possibly, you know, near its borders in the West Bank in exchange for other land, which actually the final Israeli offer didn't come at Camp David. It came at Taba, which was about 4 or 5 months after Camp David, which actually acknowledged some of the same principle. The percentage that the Israelis were prepared to give up of the West Bank grew from Camp David to Taba.
And how do you handicap the likelihood of this being proposed at the Arab League meeting in Beirut next month?
Well, I think a lot of it's going to depend on the situation on the ground in the next couple of weeks. And obviously, if there's a very high degree of violence, it's probably not likely to be pushed. The Saudis seem to have been holding back. And the chances of a high degree of violence, of course, in the Middle East are ever-present. But essentially, I think the Saudis have seen a very positive response, and they've seen that essentially they've reopened the question of, you know, the diplomatic channel, and all the sort of peace-minded elements, both within Israel, with the Europeans and so on, the mediators from you know, even Shimon Peres, the foreign minister, has really stressed that there's not going to be an effective ceasefire until there's some political horizon reestablished for the Palestinians.
Well, maybe this is the horizon. Tony Caron, thanks very much for joining us. Tony Caron is senior editor at Time.com. He writes a weekly column on international affairs. Dave is on the line. Welcome, Dave. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I hope you can hear me. I'm outside with my cell phone.
We hear
right
you
now,
just so. Fine.
Okay. I have a question for Dennis Sullivan, and my question is about the proposal that has been put forth several times now to have observers on the ground.
U.S. observers or U.N.?
No, international observers.
Uh-huh. In the West Bank.
In the West Bank. And I was wondering, given the new Saudi proposal, would the U.S. be more open to that idea now than they were before?
Dave, thanks for your call. Dennis Sullivan, we're coming up on a break, but quickly, your response?
Yeah, I doubt that the U.S. will be as receptive. However, what I'd also like to say is there's an opportunity that Ariel Sharon, of all people, gave us with the notion of this barrier between West Bank and Israel proper.
You mean a literal barrier, a wall?
Yeah, when he was talking about some kind of buffer zone, the idea should be, because it comes from Sharon, I don't think it really can be fully trusted because we know of his hardline policies. However, someone must be influencing him in some way. I'm not saying that it's a great idea, but the idea of international observers could fit into the notion of a separation between Israel and the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the Palestinians and West Bank and Gaza. So I think it's still an idea that that the United States should, in fact, keep alive.
It's a new political horizon being provided by the Saudi proposal. What do you think? Do you trust that Israel can have peace if it withdraws from the West Bank and Gaza? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Saudi peace plan. It dropped out of the blue in a conversation that Thomas Friedman, New York Times columnist, reported in a February 17th column. He said he was sitting with Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah. He said, would it work if the Israelis would retreat to their pre-1967 borders and the Arab League would recognize Israel? And the Saudi Crown Prince said, what do you know? I've got just that proposal in my desk drawer. And from that sort of thin reed of a beginning. It's now become quite something. The European Union foreign policy chief Javier Solana is in Israel. He's headed now to Saudi Arabia, cutting short his visit to Israel to talk with the Saudis. He said today that Sharon has indicated to him that he would be ready to meet anybody from Saudi Arabia, formally, informally, publicly, discreetly, whatever is the quote. Something's going on here. We're looking at what it is tonight. How do you read the motivations of Saudi Arabia now, of Israel, of the Palestinians? And can the United States afford to let Israeli-Palestinian conflict go on? Can the U.S. help create a solution? Should Washington support the Saudi peace plan? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We are joined by Dennis Sullivan. He's chairman of the Political Science Department at Northeastern University, by our own news analyst, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, and now by Gidi Greenstein. Gidi Greenstein is former secretary of the Israeli delegation for peace negotiations with the Palestinians from 1999 to 2001. He worked at Camp David with Prime Minister Barak and the Israeli team. He's currently a fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening and welcome, Gidi Greenstein.
Good evening, Tom, and thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks for being with us. Gidi Greenstein, help us make sense of how this all might look from the Israeli perspective. Here's a plan, a proposal lofted out of Saudi Arabia. How does it look to you?
I think that this proposal or set of ideas fall within the greater Israeli dilemma of what should be Israel's political strategy. As you know, there are three options on the table. The idea of unilateral disengagement from the Palestinians, i.e., an Israeli withdrawal not within the context of any agreement with the Palestinians. There is another set of ideas that entertain the concept of interim agreement, meaning that Israel would withdraw in exchange for some security and economic arrangements without touching on the difficult issues of refugees or Jerusalem. And there's a third school that speaks about some kind of permanent status agreement, going back to another major attempt to bring an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And Saudi ideas or the Saudi initiative falls clearly within the third school of this debate going on in Israel.
Let me ask you this. I guess it's always a fundamental question in the backdrop. The Saudis are saying that if this agreement could come to pass, that they would support the Arab League confirming its recognition of the Israeli state. In other words, removing the threat that lack of recognition has always meant that somehow Israel simply wasn't fundamentally accepted. Do you think that Israelis would be prepared to trust an Arab League pronouncement to that effect, as historic as it might be?
I think that this message is a very, very important message because it reinforces the concept of normalization. As you know, basically we are in many ways the train has left the station on a number of issues with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
What do you mean by that metaphor? Is this the facts on the ground idea or something else?
It means that it is clear that Israel will withdraw, and it is clear, and Sharon has recognized that, and Peres has recognized that all the way to the left side of the Israeli political spectrum. Mm-hmm. It is clear that there will be a Palestinian state, and we're moving into a level of state-to-state management of the relations.
Then why all the fighting?
Because we are caught in a catch-22 of violence in which Israel and the Palestinians have diametrically opposing sequences in mind. For the Palestinians, it is first of all a political prospect and then an end to violence. For the Israeli side, it is first an end of violence and then the political prospect. This is captured by Sharon saying, I will not negotiate under fire. And when both sides have diametrically opposing sequences, the ceasefires keep on collapsing one after the other because there is nothing that could hold them together. There's no holding environment that would keep both sides within that process that would funnel them back to the political process.
Why are the sequences held so dearly, even at the cost of all this blood, Gidi Greenstein?
Because on the Palestinian side, I'm not a Palestinian, but to the extent that I can step into their shoes, their perception is that after such a great sacrifice within the context of this uprising, they cannot go back to the negotiation table with absolutely no guarantee that there is a political prospect for a viable Palestinian state that is contiguous in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This is from the Palestinian perspective to the extent that I can understand it. On the Israeli side, violence or the Palestinian waiver of the use of violence as means for the political engagement with Israel has been the pillar of the Oslo process, and the use of violence basically violates the basic tenet of the entire peace process since 1993. So both sides are caught in this dynamics, a catch-22 of violence that keeps on going and basically drags the entire region into greater instability.
Gidi Greenstein, you've been at the table when peace was so very close. You've seen it at very intimate range. What's your interpretation of why the Saudis are coming in with this plan now?
I think that the Saudis, there's of course the U.S.-Saudi agenda, which is separate, and Dennis Ross has related to, and I agree with him. There's also this fear that there will be a spillover effect of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict into the moderate Arab regimes in Egypt and in Jordan and even in Saudi Arabia. But this is also some kind of a way, what the Saudis are doing, I believe, is they're bringing back the Clinton ideas of December 23rd, 2000 through the back door.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the Bush administration has difficulty endorsing the Clinton ideas. And these ideas have been the outcome of negotiations in different settings since the collapse of the peace process across the period of time between September 2000 and January 2001. Various groups have identified the Clinton ideas as the only possible point of departure, or terms of reference for renewal of negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, the Saudis, I believe, are bringing back through the back door this set of ideas that were an outcome of extensive negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians between 1999 and 2001.
That's an interesting framing of it, that they're bringing it back through the back door. What do you think the odds are of this Saudi plan continuing to have traction, that this might indeed lead to a resumption of negotiations and a reduction in violence?
I think that there's still a long way to go. I think that on the Israeli side, as well as on the Palestinian side, the dilemma is history versus politics. I want to be very careful when I speak about the Palestinians, but when I observe the Israeli side, Sharon has a coalition that makes it very difficult for him to move to the right or to the left.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has a date with destiny. This is a 73-year-old man. He's been around for 50 years, and I'm sure he has his legacy in mind. And I am confident that the more frustration that comes out of this conflict, the more he has to engage different concepts of political resolution that he may have not voted for before he became prime minister. So in a way, although it's a very dark reality, I am optimistic because there are a few beams of light emerging from the region over the last few months, and the Saudi initiative is certainly one of them.
Gidi Greenstein, we're very grateful to you for joining us tonight. We're going to have to get you back on the show. I know we have to let you go now. Thanks a lot for coming on tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gidi Greenstein is former secretary of the Israeli delegation for peace negotiations with Palestinians from 1999 to 2001 and was at Camp David with Prime Minister Barak and the Israeli team. We have a lot of callers. Let's try and bring them in. Barry's on the line. Welcome, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is really, why is it that suddenly the Saudis, who funded the madrasas,
mm-hmm.
that taught the hatred, that, you know, have given us untold hundreds of thousands of anti-Western and anti-Israeli jihadists, are suddenly the avatars of peace at face value with this plan?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that if this has been sitting in the Saudi minister's desk drawer for quite some time, why wasn't he telling all kinds of national statements,
mm-hmm.
You know, like the mullah in Iran, who a few weeks ago said, you know, soon the Arab world, the Muslim world will have an atomic bomb and we can drop one bomb on Israel and they can't destroy the entire Arab world.
Mm. It is a huge about-face, isn't it, Barry? Jack Beatty...
It isn't an about-face. I mean, why do you take it as an about-face?
Well, it certainly is in terms of Saudi history. The Saudi Arabia hasn't come forward before promoting normalization, and I take your point that this is in sharp contrast to the madrasas and the hardline Islamic front that Saudi Arabia has been presenting. I want to put that to Jack Beatty. Jack, you know, Barry raises a very interesting question. And, of course, we've heard and discussed over the months since 9/11 this very delicate tightrope that the Saudi ruling family has had to walk. On the one hand, being supportive of the fundamentalists who are the backbone of their support within Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, needing a relationship with the United States and the world.
Yeah, and I take Barry's point. I mean, where were the Saudis at Taba? Where were the Saudis when their intervention really would have meant something, when Arafat was on the cusp? I mean, people were writing at the time, the silence from Saudi Arabia. They didn't do anything. When peace was at hand, they didn't act. Now they had this tremendous public relations problem in the United States and in the West, and they act. I don't see how one cannot be but skeptical about it, although it tells you something about the Israelis and how desperate things are, that they are seizing on it, that they're willing to talk about it. But I think the context of it is has a lot to do with Saudi necessities internally and with the U.S. As much as it does with a, you know, with the fact with the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Yeah, if I could add on this, it
doesn't, Dennis Sullivan.
Yeah, thanks. Even if we take it at less than face value, the fact is we should take it and run with it. This is an opportunity that the United States desperately needs to get re-engaged in a very active way. If it comes from Iran, if it comes from Saudi Arabia, I don't care where it comes from. The reality is Israel, the Palestinians, they need us to be engaged. So if there's any hope for putting an end to first the cycle of violence and then getting back on a track, the Saudis could have said nothing about us, any specifics, just the fact that they could raise the idea that there should be a peace treaty between Israel and the Palestinians is enough for us to take it.
Even if it's mercenary, it may be worth taking hold of.
We're mercenaries when it comes to our national interest. That's what we have to do. And it is in our national interest to get the Israelis and the Palestinians out of the cycle of violence and to be, as much as we can be, a mediator and a facilitator of negotiations.
We hear that. Barry, thank you for your call. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. I was going to say that my original quest has, I think, been in large part covered. So I just want to pick up on two quick points. I think that, you know, perhaps the reason that this idea is being floated out by the Saudis is really relates back to September 11th in the sense that when you think about what are some of the major grievances that you hear coming out of the Arab world, certainly the Middle East conflict is one of them. And so maybe this is an effort to basically try and short circuit that.
To calm the waters, you mean, Imran?
Yeah. So, like, if you can, especially if you can negotiate the peace and hopefully bring justice to the situation, so that both parties, the Arabs and the Israelis. Or rather, the Palestinians and the Israelis can live a normal life, then that basically could simmer the region down. The other thing I wanted to pick up on what Jack said earlier was that, you know, people were so close to a deal they didn't take it. But the question is, you know, was it a good deal? And, you know, the Oslo peace process, I know everyone talks about it as being something that was within reach, but you know, from the Palestinian perspective, my understanding of the situation was that it's a bad deal. You know, it fenestrates the entire West Bank and Gaza such that the only way that you can walk from one city to the other is through dirt roads, or if that's possible.
Well, they certainly didn't take it, and one has to assume they had their reasons. Imran, our time is running down, but I want to thank you for that. Dennis Sullivan, your thought real quickly. Is this, in fact, an expression of Saudi Arabia looking for a way to regain its footing?
I'm not sure, and I almost don't care, in the sense that it's a great opportunity for us. I do believe, I mean, to be serious, it is to get back a sense that they are a legitimate friend or ally, whatever they want to consider themselves, to the United States. That's good enough for me for now for U.S.-Saudi relations. But I think far more significant, frankly, is U.S.-Israel and U.S.-Palestine and U.S.-Egypt and U.S.-Jordan and U.S.-Arab world relations overall.
Well, and all that remains to be seen. We'll hold our breath. Dennis Sullivan, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Dennis Sullivan is chairman of the Political Science Department at Northeastern University and has worked extensively with the Middle East. Jack Beatty, our time is running down, but there we are again. A peace proposal from an unexpected quarter, and out of desperation, people are turning to it.
Yes, and as Dennis Ross said, I think Mr. Sullivan said as well, for whatever motives, it now has momentum, and one can only hope the momentum will take hold.
Yeah, we'll say a prayer for that. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.